From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum, the daily call-in program bringing you wide-ranging discussions of current issues, as well as in-depth interviews with the people who are shaping our world.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, we'll be joined by author and journalist Gregory Rodriguez, who has written an ambitious history of Mexican immigration and a book all about the future of race in the United States. It's called Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds. He'll talk with us about racial and cultural synthesis and about the impact and meaning of Spanish Indian and Anglo-Latino mixes, all after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Gregory Rodriguez directs the California Fellows Program and is an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan policy institute. He's an op-ed columnist for the Los Angeles Times and author of a recently published book about Mexican immigration and the future of race in the United States. It's called Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, and he joins us for this hour. And welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, right away, of course, one notices the title, and do we want to start talking about the title before we talk about the book?
It's as good a place to start as any. I think it's meant to be a bit provocative, but it's also straight out of the book. And it's really referring to the people who didn't belong in strict racial systems, people who were not, who were either or. And as the emergence of the mestizo mixed nation in Mexico, these are people who didn't belong in the Spanish colonial racial system, which really had divided the country between white Spaniards and Indians. And they were not to have mixed. Both the crown and the church didn't want them to mix. But they did. So the original use of the word mestizo was synonymous with bastard by 1530. And these are people, because they didn't belong in a system, the economic system or the legal system, often became vagabonds. They were also people who were literally on the street. They had no status in society. And orphans comes in many ways, it's straight out of Octavio Paz, this notion that this people, this mixed people, were somehow they'd become unattached, unmoored from both their progenitors, both their Spanish side and their indigenous side. They were orphans constantly looking for their origins. And as Mexicans, as the mestizo came north, they were often referred to most poignantly by Senator Calhoun of South Carolina and by then Secretary of State James Buchanan as mongrels.
It's amazing how much of this history brings us even right up to the present. I mean, you do a really formidable job, it seems to me.
Appreciate
going
it.
Back to the Spanish conquest in the 16th century and bringing us forward to this racial and cultural synthesis, mestizaje. And we begin, actually, with the racial and cultural synthesis that was emblematic in 1993 here in San Francisco. Carlos Fernandez testifying, San Francisco lawyer and an activist, testifying about what would eventually bring a change to the census. That was a really landmark moment.
Absolutely. And I found it by accident as I was writing the end of my book. I had no idea. I was essentially writing at the end how Mexican Americans were confusing the Anglo-American racial system, in this sense, the Census Bureau. And I had no idea that one of the primary testimonies, the most convincing testimonies, was from a Bay Area resident named Carlos Fernandez. I've never met the man, so if he's out there, hello. If I recall correctly, his father was Mexican, mother was Anglo-American, and he had read up on the history of mestizaje and the struggles and the strengths of those of mixed race background, and his testimony to a House subcommittee really helped convince the U.S. government to allow Americans to be able to choose more than one race on the 2000 census.
Well, before 1970, as you point out in your book, mestizajes were insisting they were white. In fact, Mexicans in general were insisting they were white.
Well, for the longest time, I mean, essentially because this was a a binary racial system, and it still is to a great degree. Mexican Americans didn't fit into the American racial system. From 1850 to 1920, Mexicans were considered de facto white. In 1930, they were reclassified as Mexican. Their race was Mexican. Then, with help from FDR being lobbied by the Mexican government, they became white again. By 1980, Hispanics could be of any race, as we know now. So I think...
In fact, let me back you up a minute. Okay. What about just that word Hispanic? I mean, it's become such a kind of free-floating signifier.
Exactly. I mean, Hispanic and Latino, to me, I use sort of interchangeably. You can argue all you want about it, but they're both really sort of generic blob terms. They're useful on some level. There is sort of continuity among Latin American nations, and there's some sort of shared... But it ultimately, it's a generic term that doesn't allow for the distinctions of national origin, which are all important. Because if you ask somebody on the street whether first, second, or third generation Latino American, their grandparents or their parents didn't come from Latinolandia. They came from Cuba or Mexico. And for some reason, for the last 30 years, as there's been more and more people of Mexican origin in the United States, the less and less we use the word Mexican.
It changes as the generations go on. I mean, clearly, in fact, there's going to be less of that identification, but as there's more hybridization and as there's mm-hmm. more of this mix, which gets us to one of the other theses in your book, which I will get to in a moment here. But getting back to this whole idea, when did Mexicans decide to become... Or when were they designated as people of color? When did the brown come in? And the Chicano movement, pretty much, no?
Well, I mean, yes. In the 60s, I think it was a confluence of both sort of cultural, a cultural emergence in the 60s to the Third World Movement and sort of to identify.
Black consciousness, too.
Yes, yeah. Very much influenced by the Black Power movement. And the idea that one should celebrate one's indigenous side. And then, though, there was a political legal side whereby there were suddenly advantages. Affirmative action, race-based policies, affirmative action, voting rights. And Mexican-American advocates then sort of fought for Mexican-Americans to be considered non-white. So almost overnight, we went from sort of white people to non-white people. I argue that now, as we get big enough and strong enough and politically and more confident culturally, we will less and less sort of try to play either side of the black-white racial divide and say, we are brown, we are mixed.
Talking with Gregory Rodriguez and... His new book is out and available, and again, the title, rather provocative title, Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, but the subtitle, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. You say here, actually in Chapter 9, when you talk about mongrel America and the new assimilation, as much as Mexican-American officials found Chicano activists annoying, some found them useful in promoting their own agendas. Activists were more effective at focusing attention on issues and creating pressure for change than politicians were by themselves. Furthermore, the presence of angry protesters sometimes strengthened the negotiating hand of moderate Mexican-American officials in their dealings with other members of the establishment. So it's been, and yet that's changing. There's a shift here. There's a kind of tectonic shift, as you see it. And maybe what it amounts to is, the death of the Chicano movement?
I think we'd safely say
a little premature to cook.
Absolutely not. The Chicano movement, I would say, died about 1974. And its legacy really lived on. As I showed in my book, a lot of those who participated in the Chicano movement actually went in. Their safe harbor was the academy. And they went into the academy and they taught. So they, even as their student bodies changed, they still, that's where the ideology lived on. But in particular, there's sort of a neat connection between an actual real life Mexican-American political empowerment has led to the death of activism on another level. Because you see, before, when there were no Latino officials, then someone could step up and print some stationery and say, hello, Mr. Media, I represent all Latinos. And the media went along with it. And the media would call, hello, Mr. Mexican, what do your people think? That's harder to do. So the actual emergence of Latino officials in Sacramento and Los Angeles and all over the country has actually weakened the old activist base. It's a great irony.
Yet there's still this competition of, and you write about it in your book, of who's more victimized, who's more poor, who needs help to a greater degree, and with a growing middle class, of course, that's been diluted as well, but it still persists.
It does persist, and to some extent it should persist as part of the American game. That's part of the American how-to-get-money game.
How to get the piece of the pie.
How to get the piece of the pie, how to put your worst foot forward. But at the same time, it's becoming incongruous. When you have... large-scale political victories, one after the other, with the Fabian Nunez is raised in Tijuana, the California Assembly Speaker. We had a lieutenant governor. We had the mayor of Los Angeles. So that sort of political triumphalism is incongruous with the notion of victimization. And we're getting to the point where we are the Mexican-American political class has also reached a glass ceiling. Antonio Villaraigosa doesn't want to be the Latino mayor of Los Angeles. He doesn't want to be the Latino governor of California. He wants to be the mayor of Los Angeles and the governor of California.
Bill Richardson doesn't want to be the Latino president.
Absolutely not.
In fact, Bill Richardson says about your book, smart, fun, eminently readable, explores five centuries of cultural collisions and convergences and dares us to imagine a new way of thinking about the future of America. And we're talking about a racial future here that, well, that represents something that Eldridge Cleaver, there's a name from pulling way out of the past, said doesn't exist. Or even going before him, the Swedish sociologist Gunnar Myrdal said doesn't exist. The melting pot.
I think the melting pot does exist, but it was essentially exclusive to whites. It was a white ethnic phenomenon. Even Israel Zangwill, the British-born Jewish playwright who popularized the notion of the melting pot, he got heat. He got heat by the early 19-teens. He was challenged by sort of Jewish leaders of New York and saying, what are you talking about, melting pot? What are you talking about, assimilation? And he wrote an afterword to the printed edition of his play in 1914 in which he said, well, I don't mean to imply that this requires gamic interaction, sex, biological exchange. So even Israel Zangwill backed off on the notion that we would be mixing races. Actually, the melting pot only included, only welcomed white ethnics. What I'm talking about is a new re-emerging melting pot that not only mixes ethnicities, but it mixes races as well. Racial mixing has become more acceptable. And I think this is happening in American culture at large, but Mexican-Americans are hastening the acceptance of this process. You know, the court case that led to the end of the anti-miscegenation laws in California was filed by a Mexican-American woman. Andrea Perez, Perez versus Sharp, she was a Mexican-American woman who wanted to marry an African-American boyfriend. That case went to the California Supreme Court. That led to the end of anti-miscegenation laws in California.
So Tiger Woods is the new America, something along those lines?
On some level, but I'm not arguing that Hispanicity will go away. Hispanicity will stay. Mexicanists will stay. The numbers are too great. But what happens with the mixing is the definition of Hispanic broadens. The definition of what it means to be Mexican broadens. And we see it in the California Latino legislative officials. We see they're often intermarried. A Hilda Solis congressman from Southern California, married to a Palestinian. Lucille Roybal Allard. Allard is her Southern-born Anglo husband. And we see Assemblywoman Jenny Oropesa, German-Mexican. They're Hispanic. They're in the Latino caucus, but the definition is broadening.
You write about Robert Putnam, at least one of your columns.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, well, he's been on the program, and I think I read your column in the Miami Herald, so you don't only write for the LA Times. Let's make that clear.
I get lots of republished pieces throughout the country.
So you're syndicated. Yeah. He's pretty hard on the notion of diversity. He thinks, in fact, that he erodes trust, that he faces trust.
It absolutely does. I believe the new study he did, which he released, it was a survey of 30,000 Americans, perhaps more. What he's not doing is this. He's not saying, oh, diversity is all great, but nor is he saying, is it leading to race war? What he's really concluding through his survey, and he was himself very scared to release this survey because he's a good liberal academic.
Put it in a Swedish publication.
Absolutely. But suddenly I found that Swedish publication. And he's arguing that actually the more diverse a place, the less civic trust there is, that people aren't actually entrenching themselves in their own group and then beginning to fight amongst each other. He's saying they're actually receding. He calls it the turtle effect, that diversity does create challenges. But we know that. I live in the middle of Los Angeles. I live in Koreatown, and a woman who cuts my hair is from Korea and speaks 8 words of English. Are there ways that I could communicate to her that I'm losing hair here or there? The nuances of language we lose. We lose all sorts of nuances. Putnam is not saying diversity is bad. He's saying it's a challenge, and we have to deal with that challenge squarely. And I respond in a similar way to Putnam is, for 40 years, we have rightly emphasized the need to accept and tolerate and celebrate cultural pluralism. But now that the country is 12% foreign-born, just shy of the historic records of 1880 and 1910, which was 15% foreign-born, that's the high point in U.S. history. Now that we're so foreign-born, now that we're so one in four Californians is foreign-born, we have to talk about what we share. We have to talk about a shared political and civic culture that keeps us together.
You mentioned the Korean woman in your neighborhood, and it reminded me, Richard Rodriguez, whom we work we both admire, has said that, you know, he lives here in San Francisco in a Chinese neighborhood, and in some ways he's become ethnically Chinese just from absorbing a lot. I mean, this suggests that some sort of acculturation or assimilation process in that microcosmic way is taking place on a much broader plane. In fact, that's pretty much sort of your thesis. It took place in Mexico through all the hybridization. It'll take place here in the United States. And yet there are those who are clearly afraid that they're going to lose that identity in the process. You know, the Hispanicity, which you call, is going to somehow get trounced on.
Absolutely. But that's the poignancy of America. I mean, America has been a continual history of losing our mooring, losing our past, losing the multiculturalism in a way. It emerged, remember, in the early 1970s. It was a point in American history where there was the lowest percentage of foreign-born residents. Multiculturalism emerged when the average white American was third or fourth generation already. Multiculturalism, on some level, was born of nostalgia. The Chicano movement, on some level, was born of nostalgia.
Aztec roots and all that.
In 1970, 85% of Mexican Americans were U.S. born. 55% of them were third generation. There was already a distance from their past. And this is the history of America. It's a sad exchange. And every immigrant group has had to make it, but they make it. And now I think America is a more tolerant place. It's a more open, it's a more globalized place that allows us and knows that this notion that assimilation means homogenization, that you have to all become alike, is ridiculous. It's an absurdity that we've actually never done it that way.
Actually, the other fear from the other side, and you hear this sort of clarion call often, is that places like Southern California, where the Mexican population is becoming so preeminent, that Americans are going to lose the Americanness, that everybody's going to be speaking Spanish. Mm-hmm. You're going to have these little enclaves and little barrios and mm-hmm. areas where you've got within the United States, like in Florida, Cuban, and so forth, mm-hmm. you're going to have essentially mm-hmm. autonomous areas that undermine the whole idea of assimilation, that mm-hmm. go against it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's kind of arguments both ways, really, isn't it?
Well, the actual effect is opposite. I mean, Laredo, Texas, one of my favorite cities in America, has the biggest George Washington Day celebration of any city in America. And each year around obviously in February, that you'll see these Mexican American girls dress up to go to the Martha Washington Ball, and it's a sort of debutante season as well. What you'll find there is that's not at all what occurs. What people retrench into their own cultural enclaves when they're defensive, when they're 1 in 15, when they're 1 in 20, they try to form groups to survive. When people get more numerous, they become more confident. There's an emergence. There's a wait a second, we have power to move beyond ourselves. And that's what's happening politically. Look at what Proposition 187 did. It was an attack in many ways, and it was taken by Mexican Americans as an ethnic attack. Did it lead to a retrenchment? No, it actually led to a real hastening of the civic integration process. It led for Mexican immigrants who had long sat on the fence, who wouldn't naturalize. Suddenly they naturalized, they registered, and they voted. It led to increased civic integration.
I think that's a good argument. I think what we hear from people like Tom Tancredo and others, though, who are so opposed vehemently to immigration, is that it's going to lead somehow to the undermining of American institutions. They're going to become more and more like Mexican. Because of in fact, what you often hear is, here's this loyalty of immigrants who come here from Mexico to, say, the Mexican soccer team, to, you know, they're sending all this money back home and so forth, and therefore they're not loyal to the United States. This is, I mean, these typical xenophobic argument. Mm-hmm. And it's an argument that many Americans face value, accept.
And I say, on one level, I sympathize, because I grew up in Los Angeles, and I'm a Los Angeles Dodger fan. And I always resented the fact that my uncle from New York rooted for the New York teams, and my uncle from Boston rooted for the Boston teams. And I said, why don't they? It's the same. It's very similar. It's a nostalgic attachment to homeland, and that doesn't somehow translate into civic and national loyalty to Mexico. It's a pride in having been from Cleveland, and you continue to root for the Cleveland team. team. So I think we've overestimated these scenarios of Mexicans.
No, I was from Cleveland.
Team.
What do you envision, though?
You're from Cleveland?
Yeah, yeah.
We'll talk about that after hours.
What do you envision for the future of race, then? You envision this hybridization process to continue along assimilation lines and really make for a melting pot or a new kind of melting pot?
Well, I think absolutely. That's happening. That's happening already. And I think what Mexican Americans bring to the process is this language, is the experience of it, is people who have written about it eloquently, Richard Rodriguez among them, Octavio Paz, John Philip Santos, Chicana poet, the Gloria Anzaldúa. We've been grappling with it. Mexicans and Mexicans have been grappling with this mixture of race for 500 years, and we're bringing.
You know Victor Hernandez Cruz's work?
I don't know. So I think we're bringing some sort of an informed language. Not that Mexicans have solved any of these problems. Mexico itself has still not solved the collision of the old and new worlds. And we don't have to get into this, but hopefully I'm actually offering up a new Genesis myth for Mexicans so that they can deal with their mixture in a way that they haven't done over 500 years.
We're talking about poets. I'm also thinking of Gary Soto. I don't know
Absolutely.
If you know his work. But,
fantastic,
you know,
yeah.
But there's that poem of his where he's racing with the illegal immigrants. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's an American citizen,
yeah.
But somehow he's at work and they have to race out, and he goes along with them. And then he realizes, you know, I'm running as an American now, you know, even though I'm still with these illegal immigrants, or I'm still seen in that.
No, he's he's a phenomenal poet. I'm a big fan.
We're talking to Gregory Rodriguez, who writes for the op-ed page for the LA Times. I have two op-ed page writers here with us this morning on Forum. He's also the author of a new book. It's called Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. What do you say when people broach the whole subject of Mexican immigration with you? There's a lot of concern, even by the non-xenophobic, that the numbers are getting out of hand, that something has to be done.
My cheap answer is that I don't really write about immigration. My concern is about integration. That's my cheap, I don't want to talk about it answer, but I guess I can't give that to you. In a bigger sense, I look to clearly mass immigration, mass undocumented immigration causes problems. It overwhelms infrastructures. It challenges our educational system, our health system, and it challenges our nation because there is a reasonable argument that there can be so many people to absorb at one time that it taxes us as a country. At the same time, what are you going to do about it? At the same time, this is mass migration. I mean, I sort of liken it to somebody saying, I hate hurricanes. Hurricanes should be illegal. I'm running for president to stop hurricanes. It's like, great, you can't stop hurricanes and you can't stop mass migration. And we've sort of proven that. What I can only hope is that America would be honest about its need for immigrants. Right now, the Bush administration, on one hand, there's roundups of undocumented around Southern California. On the other hand, they're trying to loosen some of the visa restrictions to bring more workers. Our attitude as Americans, as the U.S. government, is so dishonest. It's so duplicitous toward immigration. I can only hope that the policy becomes reasonable and economically based. That's what I would say, that we would bring people based on whether we need them or not.
Chris, when you say you're really more a spokesperson for integration than for immigration, the more immigration there is, the more necessity to integrate.
Absolutely.
And the more formidable integration becomes.
Absolutely. And the Mexican-American, given the most other migrations have had beginnings, middles, and ends. And I like to say that there is a point, and I did research on Scandinavian immigration in Minnesota, there was a point at which you could say the preponderance of Norwegian Americans were now U.S. born, and they were more likely to use English. There was a middle point. With Mexican immigration, it's continuous. It's been continuous for 150 years, so the process of integration is ongoing. It makes it very difficult to read. It makes it very difficult to see the acculturation process, as with the Gary Soto poem, sort of implies. It happens, but from the outside, people say, oh, well, they never acculturate. They still speak Spanish. They still speak in enclaves, but so yes, it's a more formidable process, and I am a believer in this nation as an immigrant nation, but to be an immigrant nation responsibly, we have to talk about the necessity of integration.
Well, we'll talk about that. In fact, we'll invite our listeners to join us in this conversation, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and Please feel free to contribute with any questions or comments you might have. Again, toll free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, it's 866-733-6786. You can also send an email, and we welcome your emails as well. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Our guest is Gregory Rodriguez, talking about Mexican immigration and the future of race in America and his new book, Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds. When we return, your phone calls on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Los Angeles Times columnist Gregory Rodriguez, who is the author of a book called Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. And we're going to go right to your calls. Bill, you're first up. Good morning.
Oh, yeah. Good morning. I have a couple comments and questions to pose on this subject. One of which is this term Hispanic, and it just seems odd to me that we love native Mexican Indian tribes as Hispanic, and along with European people of from as Hispanic also. So it just seems such a bizarre construct.
Let's go to that first.
This whole term Hispanic.
Bill, get a response from Gregory Rodriguez. I've heard that kind of query before. It leaves out Native Indians and those who are pretty much a part of the whole mestizo culture to talk about Hispanics?
Well, I essentially agree. And we speak here in America, and probably most nations, we speak about race and ethnicity and culture in shorthand. And we need to box people into as few categories as possible. And the Hispanic category, and again, this is not to say that there is no such thing as Hispanicity, or some people say Latinidad, that there's not any shared values among those of the Hispanic Catholic heritage. But
does it include, for example, those in the Philippines who speak Spanish, or those?
I am not the guy who decides these things. But I think that the caller's point is correct. I think the only way to really understand the Latino presence in the U.S. is to disaggregate, is to talk of Cuban Americans and Dominican Americans and Salvador Americans and Mexican Americans. So I think the more, and I've harangued at the L.A. Times and trying to get them to be more specific. When you say a Latino neighborhood, you're talking about a city that's largely Mexican-American latter generation, and then you go to an immigrant neighborhood and call it a Latino neighborhood. It makes no sense. It's sloppy. It's generic, and we need to be more precise in our language.
And we'll bring in Krista next. Morning, Krista.
Hi. I'm finding, living in the South Bay, that language is such a barrier to integration. I mean, I have children, and I choose to drive to Los Altos parks because if I go to certain parks in Cupertino or even Sunnyvale, there's people speaking languages that are not English, and primarily the people are not speaking English, and you can't just, join into a conversation. And sometimes if I try to talk to them and they don't speak English, and then it's, I'm kind of shy and it's very uncomfortable. It would be nice if we all spoke one language. I don't know what that language would be, but does your guest have anything to comment about language and integration?
Absolutely, and language is the one thing we do have, we should have in common. But we have to remember that throughout American history, the acculturation process has been a long, painful one. That we've tended to romanticize past immigrant experiences as people jumping off the boat and no longer eating the foods of their homeland and suddenly speaking English and driving Volvos. But essentially, this process usually takes generations. And the children and grandchildren of those people you see in the park will be speaking English. The data is pretty incontrovertible on that. And the general process among Mexican Americans is not that distinct than that from European Americans, which is the first generation tends to speak only enough English, perhaps, to get by, particularly those in the workplace. So women have a lower rate of learning English if they stay at home. The second generation tends to be bilingual. And the third generation tends to be English dominant, if not English only.
Let me thank the caller. I noticed something, and I don't know if anybody else pointed this out to you. On the flap of your book, the photograph of you. You're
handsome devil, no? Is that what you're going to say?
Sure, mirroring yours truly. But no, it's a brown photo. I mean, you're much more brown.
It's a black and white photo. What are you
talking
about?
I'm talking about your skin. I'm talking about the color, the hue of your skin is a sharper, it would be more what Richard Rodriguez calls brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that. In fact, you know, there's a whole thing about the O.J. picture in Time magazine, how they tried to make him look black and everything.
Right.
I'm just looking at you, and then I'm looking at the picture, and it's definitely darker in the photograph.
Because basically the color of one's skin changes with the seasons, right?
Well, I don't know.
You're darker in the summer.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. If you
are you saying my publisher is up to something?
I wouldn't even infer such a thing.
I wouldn't tangle with my editor.
Here are some emails before we go to more calls. This is Hugo from San Diego who writes, I agree with Mr. Rodriguez's comments that Latinismo is evolving and current identities are outdated. People like George Lopez do more to set back Latinos and Chicanos specifically because of outdated stereotypes. I am Mexican-born, grew up in Glendale, California, which is heavily populated.
I did too. I grew up there too as well.
Well, he says it's heavily populated by Armenians. Mm-hmm. Give out a shout to homeboy. And in some ways, my culture has absorbed some Armenianism. I even got married at an Armenian banquet hall with Armenian cuisine. My sister is married to an Irish-American, and I was once engaged to an Irish-Japanese woman. Although Spanish is my secondary language, my culture is not heavily Mexican, but a mixture of Chinese, Japanese, Salvadoran, Armenian, Russian, Jewish. So there you go.
There you go.
This is Alex. He says, Mr. Rodriguez, something interesting is that non-Hispanics are becoming Hispanicized as Hispanics are becoming more Americanized, such as in
Absolutely.
My family's case. I'm from an Ashkenazi Jewish, German, Irish background, and my wife is from Colombia. We speak both Spanish and English in the house. Our daughter is bilingual. We celebrate all American holidays, but love Latin food, music, and Spanish language soap operas, novellas. This in itself might surprise you, but it might surprise you even more that we live in Kentucky, and we aren't the only ones who are like this. This is from Alex in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Fantastic.
And we go to more of your calls. Roger, morning.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. I believe in time, certainly not in our time. There will be a union very similar to what we have in the European Union between Canada and Argentina. We'll simply form this union, this American union. And I believe that all the things we're going through now, all this feeling of prejudice because of race and because of differences will eventually fade away. And I think people should start thinking in those terms. Stop thinking about a nationalistic sense that America is best in everything. Start thinking about all the contributions other nations have given us.
What about, Dan Zoll, mentioned, you think about the European paradigm here in terms of amalgamation, and one shouldn't necessarily get all that hopeful. I mean, particularly with bringing in people, large immigration of people from North Africa and from the Arabic world.
Europe's doing a horrible job of integration, in part because they don't, in most European nations, Germany's the worst at it, don't look at themselves as immigrant nations. The French assume a sort of this, it's a sort of a Franco assimilation policy, which is you have to become French. You know, you realize the government of France doesn't even count people. They don't even consider any other ethnicity than French.
Let me go to more of your calls, and we go next to Ricky in West Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning. My question for Mr. Rodriguez was, how does he feel about Hillary Clinton's refusal to answer the question in the debate last night about undocumented immigrants having driver's license?
Actually, she didn't refuse. She just contradicted herself. She gave two answers, I think, at least as when I heard the tape. But
Feel about that?
Maybe even the issue about illegal immigrants getting driver's licenses. It's been certainly Hispanic politicians, use your word Hispanic or Latino politicians.
I prefer. It doesn't matter to me.
Have been very strong on this, as you know.
I think we should. I think it's a matter of public safety. I think we should de-ethnicize the issue. The problem is that too many people who are opposing it are making it an ethnic issue and sort of an illegal immigration issue. But it really comes down to
a security issue.
It's a public safety issue. I want to be able to drive in the middle of Los Angeles, and if I hit somebody or if they hit me, I want them to have papers and insurance. So I look at it in the most pragmatic way possible. I think it's a ridiculous issue, and like everything else around illegal immigration, has become deeply emotional and ethnicized and polarized.
How do you feel about the word illegal? I don't care for that word, illegal immigrants. I prefer to use undocumented
immigrants.
No, I mean, again, I mean, I don't get caught up in the semantics. There's a lot of important issues that you have to go to. I totally see your point. But when I'm writing a column for the LA Times and I'm trying to get the word out and I use the term like unauthorized, you lose like 17,000 readers right there. Speak to it. In newspapers, you tend to use the most accessible language possible to reach the most people.
On the radio
possible.
Too.
And frankly, no one uses the word unauthorized. And when you do, what you do is you get 17,000 emails from some kooks from an anti-immigrant website who are saying, am I unauthorized? Authorized if I rob a bank? It just gets into, it's a red herring and it wastes time.
Ricky, thank you for the call. And let me go next to Judy. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I too did kind of late, so I'm not sure if you already covered this, but one of my concerns, I'm not anti-religious and I'm not anti-Mexican, but I am anti-illegal immigrants of any kind. The thing is about religion. I mean, we have a terrible overpopulation in the world, and people of they're mostly Catholic, the Mexican immigrants, and they have lots and lots of children. And we seem to make allowances for that. But like, say, for example, what if it was multi religion that I shouldn't work, or that became a huge subculture, or that I should, kill the white infidel, what's your comment, please?
All I can tell you is that, yes, people bring cultures to the United States, and as much as they adapt, sometimes we adapt to them. And if it's any comfort to you at all, it's probably not, that fertility rates do decline by generation among Mexican origin people in California. And that's why the California Department of Finance just reevaluated its ethnic projections for the next several decades, because they hadn't taken into account that when they started projecting forward, they were basing the numbers of Mexican origin children birthed in California on the early 90s. And there was a Mexican baby boom at that time in California. And it was really a consequence of the IRCA 1986 law that allowed so many undocumented to become legalized. And there was a pent-up desire for babies. And so what's happened is that demographers are now lowering their estimates of the number of children, Latino children, born over the next some generations. But I think it's still higher than Anglos in the end. But
I think it is.
I think it's more in the less than 3 per woman zone.
And thank you. Anglo-Latino children are by far the most common mixture of interracial or interethnic children in California.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, interethnic of all interethnic interracial unions in this state, 2/3 of them involve a Latino on either side of the partnership.
What about the high, and some of it is undocumented and unauthorization, a lot of it, no doubt, but the high numbers, which far exceed any other group, of lack of high school graduation among Latinos.
Mm-hmm. What about it?
Well, I mean, if integration is going to happen the way you're talking about, you're going to need to have more education. You're going to need to have higher rates.
Absolutely, but it's generally not going to happen in the first generation. And it's generally never happened in the first generation until we talked about Chinese immigration, which is extraordinary, which is Chinese Americans have higher rates of educational attainment than whites do in California. But really, if there's any hope of educational attainment, it's concentrating on the children, on the second generation. And that's where education becomes the key issue. But we can't get to education. We can't get to integration if we don't stop talking about unauthorized versus illegal, or Hispanic versus Latino, or until we talk about issues of integration. And those are nuts and bolts issues. And that's not an ethnic issue. It's an issue of, if we want a successful society, we have to fix our infrastructure so that we can integrate people.
Victor, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to come back to the comment about equating the flows of immigration to be like a force of a hurricane. I agree with you. It's an ongoing trend and something that will happen. But to put it in those terms really ignores the impacts of things like the U.S. farm policy and the corn subsidies that flood the Mexican market, and they have for over a decade now. U.S. trade policies like the North American Free Trade Agreement. You have the campesino organization, the corn growers, in Mexico that for years have been begging for the U.S. to end those subsidies, for the Mexican government to put tariffs back in place, which will be totally eliminated at the end of this year. You have two of the three major parties in Mexico who support that but can't get the U.S. trade representative to allow Mexico to implement that. So I'm just concerned that to put that message out.
You're absolutely right.
These people feeling powerless, yeah. Like there's no role that public policy can play in having an impact on
you're that. Absolutely right. The analogy was used for a specific purpose, which was you can be against something all you want, but it's hard to stop something that tends to be a natural phenomenon, such as mass migration. But having said that, I agree with what you're saying. So in essence, what you want me to say is that the U.S. policies, and I agree with you, seeds the clouds of those hurricanes. And we're doing, yes, absolutely active policies for years, even before the events that you're talking about, have actually reached into Mexico to bring people northward. You're absolutely right. We have a responsibility as a nation, as a government, to stop, to take responsibility for the waves that come northward. The United States helped create those highways that led to people in small villages in Mexico becoming familiar with jobs in San Francisco and San Leandro and Glendale, California. So your point is absolutely well taken.
And you know, the hardliners will say what you need to do is you need to have more crackdown, especially on employers. What you need to do is you need to build a fence or some kind of a wall. I mean, you hear all of these schemes that move or don't move, as the case may be, but are meant to obstruct the hurricane, as you put it.
Yes, and that seems to be the answer of the moment, and it doesn't seem to be working all that great. And again, it doesn't answer the question that I'm most concerned about. What do we do about those who are here, about the children who are here? The constant obsession with immigration has led us astray, and not to worry about something that's a previous caller, what we really have power over is issues of integration, because it has to do with our infrastructure and our schools. And
well, one of the things that certainly buttresses your argument is the United States, unlike just about any other country, will allow for those who were born on this soil, regardless of their parentage, documented, undocumented, to be American citizens. And that speaks certainly to the likelihood of eventual movement toward assimilation, although there was a Florida congressman who tried to, of course, put the kibosh on that.
Right. And a California congressman, Elton Gallagher.
That's right. Gallagher was involved in that, too. Here's Letitia, who says, Greg, calling you Greg, mentioned that America has never been more tolerant. There's probably some truth to that on certain levels, though I would push back on that notion. In San Diego, near the border where I'm from, I have seen big increase in open hatred toward Mexicans. My lifelong Anglo friends now think nothing of saying openly racist comments about the Mexicans in front of me, as if I were not also of Mexican descent. My nephew is...
She's running along aside like Gary Soto.
Yeah. Well, she goes on to say, my nephew was told that he could not use the bathroom at a gas station in Ramona because Mexicans have to go outside in the bushes. That's illegal, of course. This kind of thing did not happen when I was growing up in San Diego. I feel like it's Jim Crow, but this time the target are Mexicans.
Well, absolutely. Again,
growing hatred is what she says.
Absolutely. That's true. But it's nothing new. The anti-Mexican sentiment is a recurring phenomenon in the United States, and it usually occurs at times when, at hard economic times, or at this point at times when many people feel we've reached a critical mass of
when there's more dense population, there's more prejudice toward
right,
a group.
I mean, right.
Sociologists will tell you hands down empirical data.
Absolutely, and what the phenomenon I think what she's talking about is absolutely true, but it's not new, and it ebbs and wanes. But the Jim Crow might be a little too strong a term for it, but absolutely, this is what we're facing right now is a wall of prejudice. But I contest that she, with her help, her cousins or her siblings, will ultimately win over that wall and jump over it. I'm optimistic about the future.
There's a crystal ball, Gregory Rodriguez. Again, his new book is Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. And Nancy, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking the call on the program. I think it's a really brave thing you're both doing. I had two comments and then a concern. One, just as an aside, I can attest that Latin persons do get darker at different times. Both of my sons are darker at the end of the summer right now, and I'm a Mongol, and I'm turned out more white, so this was a little bit something that I've learned. I've learned many things. My mother's one of the first Latins in the Mission District, marrying an Irish Catholic. She was from Peru, and she is from Peru, actually. She's still there, so family there. Secondly, comment, I wanted to totally promote multicultural education. My boys both go to a Spanish immersion multicultural group school. They do Chinese parade. They do a lot of things, so it's not just focusing on, quote, like Mexican culture, which brings me to my concern, which I hope you take, you know, not heavily. But for, Gregory, you know, I'm hearing a lot of Mexican, and that's something that's really kind of been a little issue and sensitive, but I know I understand what you're saying, that it's good to start saying, okay, if it's not Mexican, then let's say Guatemalan, let's say this. So I'm kind of torn between how much there is a focus when they say on immigration issues, Mexican, when I do see so many people coming from not non-Mexico, Central America, South America, like my boys, and different people I know. So I'm just kind of curious there, and kind of wanted to say that sensitivity that people like me could have who are mongrels of Latin descent, but not Mexican.
No, absolutely. I just didn't presume to write about all Latinos as other people have. I wrote for Newsweek once a couple years ago when the mayor of L.A. was elected, the current mayor, and the editor required me to put in three paragraphs on all these other group experiences that I'd never – he essentially wrote them. I don't claim to speak for any – and I don't claim to speak for actually Mexicans. I'm just one writer, and my concern was to look at the group Mexicans – make up 2/3 of all Latinos in the United States. They're about 85% of Latinos in California are of Mexican origin. I'm just being specific. I think I'm just trying to be precise. And I'm even trying to show the distinctions among Mexicans themselves. And what we speak in this shorthand, the effort is not to ignore anybody. The effort is simply not to talk about experiences that I've not studied.
We thank the caller and we move to more of your calls. Jonah, morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to make a comment. My wife is from Mexico City, and we have two daughters here in the Mission. And it's been a really interesting experience being a mixed couple. But what I want to say is that there's the warmth and beauty of the Latin culture here has just been fantastic. And the funny thing is that both of our daughters ended up with blue eyes, and the people look at us and they're fascinated that we are a mixed couple, and then they look at our kids and they can't believe it. They say, "Are these your kids?" Or, you know, they think they're mine. But my wife, they ask her, "Are these your kids?" And it's just an interesting experience and something that that's constantly out there, and I enjoy our family, and it's a good situation.
Okay, we thank you for the call, and we'll just get another caller on. Fred, that's you. Good morning.
Well, good morning. You know, I wish that language were not a political weapon in this country. Ever since I've grown up, you're grown up with English, you learn to speak English, and it's almost un-American to have to learn to speak something else. Why aren't children required to be at least bilingual? Language is a tool of communication, and you would think that people would want to have as many tools to carry around in their kit, so to speak, as possible. Many people are offended if they hear others speaking another language in a supermarket or in the workplace or something like that. But I come from the school of I wish I spoke that language so I knew what they were talking about.
Well, let me actually, Fred, thank you for the comment. Take that comment and go to Natalie, who I think's comment dovetails a bit on this. Natalie, hi. So now we're talking about English and monolingual. Natalie, are you there?
Yes, I am. I can barely hear you. I just want to say that I think we don't do enough to encourage immigrants to learn English in this country. And I think it's the only thing that binds us together. Of course, I enjoy that people speak their own languages, but English should come first. And how do you succeed in business in this country if you don't know English? I'm always encouraged when I meet Latinos and they speak English.
But what about this? Actually, these last two calls bring up, of course, the whole controversy over English only and whether English. I mean, can you integrate and not take on the language of the country that you're in?
No. I mean, she's absolutely. Both callers are right. There's no, but they're not mutually exclusive. One can speak Spanish and English. One can speak Chinese and English. On one level, we don't learn English. My simple. This silly answer is Americans don't learn other languages because this is the center of the empire, because everyone else speaks English. The Economist magazine recently estimated that half the globe will speak fluent English by 2050.
And most immigrants want to learn English, want their children
absolutely.
To learn English.
And,
but yet we make it easy for them not to learn English. We have bilingual ballots. We have, you know, all of these ways that
do you know how many people use bilingual ballots? You know what a red herring that is? L.A. County, largest county in the nation, most populous county, larger than 42 states. They sent out something like 12,000 non-English language ballots a year.
The fact is,
for
we've got them, though. I mean, and it may be more symbolic, but nevertheless.
It's entirely symbolic. And the fact is, the economic advantage of English is so powerful that it's really unavoidable. And if you want to work, I mean, you can go into any border towns and find that what Mexicans don't have is an entire economic infrastructure where they're going to have, where the way Koreatown, for instance, there is an economic infrastructure that is entirely Korean, and you can function in a Korean
Spanish
bank.
Spanish-speaking television station.
Are there Spanish directories?
Can
you tell me a Mexican-American-owned bank here that all Mexicans go to? No. You can't. You basically can't.
Is there a Korean-owned bank in San Francisco?
There are many in Los Angeles and where I live. So there's not this sort of vertical economic infrastructure that Mexicans live in. They can, yes, on some cultural level, but if you want to move out of it, you clearly have to learn English. And, you know, again, the studies are pretty incontrovertible about the adoption of English over time. So, again, these are symbolic issues we tend to get mired in when we should be, if we want to know about what Mexicans are doing to the United States, we should find out what they've done, where they're coming from, and who they are.
We're almost at the end of the program. Multiculturalism. I mean, you sound skeptical about it.
No, I mean, it's fine. It had its time and place, but it has a different meanings to different people. Soft multiculturalism is absolutely fine, which means to me tolerance and acceptance. But the notion of hard multiculturalism, which really exists mostly in the academy, the notion that it's a form of the sort of cultural time sharing that the Latino gets 10 minutes and the Asian gets 10 minutes and the African American gets 10 minutes. And, of course, the white guy gets to moderate it all. He gets the last 50 minutes of the final word. I think we're growing out of it. I think on some level it is sort of acknowledged distinctions and acknowledged previously ignored groups, but at some level it's now a glass ceiling. It's not enough just to speak. You know, in my book, should it go into current affairs or should my book go into ethnic studies? There's a question, and if it's put into ethnic studies, as some bookstores have done, isn't it limiting the audience and saying, well, white folks don't have to learn about Mexican history or the history of Mexican Americans? That's what multiculturalism has done on some level. It's tend to sort of box us and marginalize us and keep us in our categories.
Gregory Rodriguez with us this hour. His book is Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration, the Future of Race in America. If you're listening to us on Sirius or down in L.A., he'll be at the L.A. Public Library on November 13th and Barnes & Noble in Torrance, November 15th. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks very much.
And we'll be back with you on tomorrow if all goes according to plan. We thank you for listening to Forum. We thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.